Princess Helena College.
That's right.
Ordinary girls. And now I made friends very quickly. And instinctively as well, with Fossey van Coydel. Von Coydel. Now Fossey van Coydel, as you can hear from the bomb, came from a similar kind of district.
How do you spell Coydel?
K-E-U-D-E-L-L. Her mother was Baroness von Coydel, and they came from Latvia, up there. So there was something rather special about her. And she used to watch my conversation. Now one evening we were all talking, and without thinking about it at all, I said to the girl, "Well, what do your butlers do?" There was a dead silence. I thought, now what on earth have I done? And Fossey took me aside and said, "You can't talk like that." I said, "Why can't I? Haven't they got butlers?" Then she said, "Of course they haven't got butlers." I said, "What do you mean? What have they got? What is safe? Have they got soap?" She said, "Yes, soap's all right."
Now, so she helped you, really,
yes,
to acclimatise,
yes,
in a way.
Yes, she showed me to help what to do. Mm-hmm. That was that one. Now, next one, their tuition. And there were two headmistresses, and one was an excellent teacher, very good indeed, and I enjoyed her classes enormously and behaved very well. One of the other teachers was absolutely hopeless, no good as a teacher. But she was teaching the class, and Flossie and I were in the same class. And one, either morning or afternoon, I couldn't bear it. And while the teacher was talking, I stood up in my desk, looked across the Flossie, which was just on the other side, and said out loud, very distinctly, "Flossie, this is more than we can bear. Come out." And we walked out. Never happened before. We were sent down, I was sent down to the headmaster's, "This is a good one." And she looked at one of them, and she said, "Why don't you do this?" Then I said, "You know how I behave in your classes. You're a good teacher. This woman oughtn't to be here. You should get rid of her." What could she do? Nothing. And that was the kind of way that it began to be obvious that there I was. I couldn't be altered.
Anyway, you obviously had ability, and you went on from that school.
Yes. Now then, Scotland came next. Now, in 1902, my parents divorced each other, my mother divorced my father, moved to Cheltenham so that her children should have the best education going. And we were enrolled in Cheltenham Ladies' College in 1902, and I stayed until 1908, and finished up by taking the first medical exam from there.
And then you went to...
And then to London School of Medicine for Women in 1910, and I got through the rest of that and to the Royal Free Hospital in 1912. 1914 qualified.
That's splendid. That gets it all up to date.
Yes.
Can we get on to late 20s now? Because yes, there was one thing I wanted to ask you, which I forgot to ask you, and that was... one of the things that's odd about the interwar British birth control movement is that usually when you get a rapid growth in an organiser, in a movement, you get schism, you get splits, you know, like Methodism in the 19th century.
I don't think you would call us rapid.
Well, you were growing.
I don't know what you're comparing it with.
Yes, I was comparing it with Methodism in the 19th century, actually. You get a series of splits in all directions because everyone feels strongly, and you split, you know, you spread in all directions. But the great thing about you is that when you start growing, you join together.
Yes, we join together.
But how does that happen?
That can be accounted for by the extreme simplicity of our aim. That the aim to help women, you can't really argue about.
Yes, but you can argue about methods, as you yourself said last time.
Yes, you can argue about methods. But here was something very odd. What we were starting then had never been done before. And it was, there weren't any grounds on which to argue. We, you might have noticed, you did see my 4-5 articles, did you?
Yes, I did, yes.
And that there, everything had to be invented. And we were keen on the criticism of all sorts. What we needed was to succeed. And if anyone would come up and say, well, I've got a better method than that, we said, come on, come in.
You should.
I want to achieve.
No, we were just talking about, you were saying that you were developing a new technique.
Yes.
Really. Can you tell me about the relationship between, you had two committees, you had the executive committee and the specialist committee.
The medical?
The medical one. How did they, what was their relative spheres and what did
their
they
do? Their relative spheres were very distinct. The medical one, of which I was the chairman for 8 years, had responsibility in providing the machinery. If you remember the early articles, at that moment, 1930, the Dutch, the New Oxford children, were farming. With this big garden, we're gradually getting the British children in.
Lovely for them, isn't it?
The Dutch had luckily invented a rubber cap. The name of the inventor?
I think I know. In the 1880s that was invented, wasn't it? I know the name.
Nice man. I've forgotten what his name is. And it was obvious the rubber cap couldn't be fitted by itself. There had to be a sperm killer. But as soon as the rubber caps were on the market, not supervised in any way, you didn't know how good the rubber was, the pharmaceutical firms realized that here was a new field. So a number of them put their laboratories to work and produced various ointments. And then one of our very first jobs, which was very funny, suddenly I said at one of the committee meetings, we are gaily prescribing these ointments to our patients at the clinic. We know nothing about them. We've got to find out. This is our responsibility. So we sent round scouts
to get random samples,
which of course is no difficulty about at all, from the various chemists. And then we had to find someone who was interested enough to do sperm tests. Now, at that time, sperms were utterly uninteresting. Nobody took any interest in at all. But we managed to find someone. We set up a laboratory in London, very simple, and we said to these people, we are going to test your product. We're going to test them in a test tube with known live fertile sperms in a definite time. We find out what happened. And we found three different things. One or two of them actually did kill sperms. Some of them did nothing at all to the sperms, and some of them actually activated them. So we realized that we were in a mad world, and that we were responsible for that world. Which made our next piece of responsibility very clear indeed. We had to make our own. Now there Pip Blapper came in. And we said, now then, Pip, you know people in Oxford, you please go to Oxford, and you'll find a young, intelligent lab worker who will stop whatever he's doing now, and who will undertake for us, for the first time in history, how do you put it? Yes, the killability of sperms. And he's got to try all sorts of different things, doesn't matter what they are, properly, in similar conditions, and produce results. Well, people said, yes, of course, that's right. And he found John R. Baker. Now, John R. Baker is quite a different person. He's a pure scientist who was engaged very deeply in his own work. He says, sperms, sperms. Nobody's interested in sperms. He said, we are. And he succeeded in getting John R. Baker for the first time in history to Gothenburg. And I think he tested something like 36 different substances. And he quickly found the sperms were very easily killed. He says, thank you, that's good. Now then, the next thing we have to do. Of all these substances, all of which kill sperms, you will please choose for us the cheapest, the one that needs the smallest quantity, and the quickest, which will be pure scientific work in a lab, which you will report to me, the medical committee, which he did. A very important report was held. Go on, eat the rest of the cake.
No, that's yours. That's yours.
No, I can't eat more than this.
Contrary, it's a very marvellous cake.
Yes, it's very concentrated.
Do you mind?
No.
Thank you very much. I will. Lovely.
Well, Sue, be pleased that you like it.
So in fact, the function of the committee is to inspire and supervise products and research, really.
Yes, you must have just one more scene. We got on a journal, which was purely academic. It was all in Oxford. Quite unpractical. And we said, now what we have to do is to choose. In London, a wholesale firm, and give them the show. And then we sell the talks to another. We were very young, totally uncommercial. And we said, this is a charity. We are listed as a charity. We will not make any profit. And we chose BDH, British Drug Houses. And we invited one of their directors to come talk to us. And this was another historic meeting. He came, we told him all facts, it was all confidential. And at the end we said, now then, Mr. whatever his name was, we want to give you the sole commission of the British birth control movement to make a new patented substance and ointment, and we will not make any profit. You are going to give us the smallest terms, which will give you the minimum trade profit. Do you remember what that man said?
Well, he said you're mad or something, didn't he?
He said, ladies, ladies, you don't know what you're doing. Slowly, like this, you're throwing away a fortune. We said, we know we are. And how stupid we were, it took us about 10 years to realize. Because that's where Elisa Jensen had much more sense. And in the Swedish movement, they made profit from everything that they made and sold supported them.
And you could finance the movement, yes, I see. You think that was a mistake, do you?
It was sentimental.
Yes, that's interesting.
It was absurd. Yeah.
Yes.
But, of course, it succeeded.
Can you tell me, while we're on techniques, it's almost, if you look at your clinic in North Kensington, You almost entirely recommend the Dutch cap and nothing else.
Yes, at that time wasn't anything else.
I mean, you don't recommend the sheath for the men at all.
Then. Ah, that's a different question. A recommend isn't exactly the word.
You see, it seems to me entirely women who are involved
in this.
Yes.
Now, this is a very sensible question.
because it's much more technical than you think. Now, we knew, of course, all about sheaths, and also realized that for a lifetime's habit of any couple, married or unmarried, to use nothing but sheaths was too hard. And how far have you thought about sheaths?
Well, I haven't much. It's just, you see, what I'm interested in is this, that you never really see the men at all, do you?
No, but I'm going to tell you why. Now, please, you can be useful to your friends this way and save them having unwanted pregnancies. In order to use a sheath perfectly successfully, four rules have to be obeyed on every occasion. First, the sheath must be put on before there's any contact at all,
yes,
between the tip of the penis and even as the region round the vaginal opening. That's all right. Second, intercourse can take place normally, movements can take place normally, they can both be perfectly happy, and the man has an orgasm. Now, he must come out before he goes limp. Which is a great trouble to lots of people. The last thing they want to think about is time.
Yes.
And now, as he comes out very carefully, he has to remove the sheath, which is not easy because semen is sticky. And the wife has, or the lover has, to produce water and a towel and to wash them very carefully, because there are 30 million sperms per cubic centimetre.
Yes.
It's a thing that people can't realise before it's safe for them to lie together. Now, that's discipline.
So supposing a husband had come, your point is that you wouldn't have recommended this technique, really?
No, we weren't recommended for them to come in at all. We would say, we would explain to you that if you wish to take this responsibility, you have got to take it as seriously as your wife does.
Yes.
Although you haven't got a uterus, although nothing will ever make you pregnant, you have got to project your imagination and realize that your responsibility is equal to hers. We can teach you very easily a method which is certain to succeed, but you won't have the character to go on with it.
Yes, and now you must, I'll
reveal... Oh, is that clear?
Yes, that's fine. I mean, I'll reveal my ignorance now and ask you this question. You have these numbers of clients, working-class women, who come to your clinic in Kensington and want advice, and you fit them with caps.
And tell them about the chemical.
Yes. Now, does the husband need to know anything about that at all? I mean, would he know?
Well, now, this, of course, is a very human question. And this came up in all sorts of ways. And we would never dictate. Our responsibility was quite clear that we had to protect the wife. What the wife did with her husband was her affair. If she wished to talk about it, we were very, very willing to talk. But if she didn't, we knew we had done the job. Now, what you're on the verge of, and which we haven't talked about at all yet, and I don't think it comes into your theme, but it comes into my theme, is the woman's part in intercourse. These women who came to our clinics, they had had no kind of sex teaching at all from anybody. I probably don't remember this famous colloquy that happened. I used to give these patients every possible chance to talk, teach them a bit more. And one evening to one of the women, I said, well, now then, Mrs. So-and-so, you've had so many children, you're now perfectly safe, you won't have another child that you don't want. Now, do you enjoy having intercourse with your husband? She looked at me completely blankly, and I realized that I might have been talking Greek. It meant nothing to her at all. So I let a little pause go by, and then I repeated the same words, the same tone. So it got across to her that this woman did mean something. And she looked at me, and she said these historic words. But, Doctor, What is there to enjoy? Now, if you look deeply into that, you've got...
It's partly the fear of pregnancy, isn't it? That's part of the lack of enjoyment.
No, I don't think that is. To do with it. For point of view of enjoyment, the total ignorance. She had never expected to enjoy anything. Her husband had never expected her either. Both of them were quite unworried. It was I who was interrupting them.
So it's purely the man's enjoyment.
Yes, it's only the man's enjoyment. The woman hadn't any idea this was possible.
And that's quite common, is it? I mean, that's
not now.
No, but I mean, it was quite common then.
It was universal.
Was it really?
Among, well, I couldn't take them so far to say completely universal, but it was so common that this conversation that I had with this woman was endlessly repeated. And it was because of that I had to go on writing. And the sex factor in marriage, you've seen that.
Yes.
Was written with that purpose.
And you never normally saw the husbands at all, or the men at all?
I never saw the husband at the clinics, no.
And as far as you were concerned, if you fit a woman with a cap, the husband need never know she's got it in. Is that right?
That was her affair.
But I mean, he wouldn't necessarily know unless she told him. I'm purely ignorant, you see, about this. I mean, is that the case?
What do you mean? He wouldn't feel it.
Yes.
He wouldn't feel it, no.
Yeah, I see. So it's
but
really
in talking, we wouldn't be quite as objective as that. We would imply that this was a mutual affair. We would imply the freedom from anxiety, which we were not offering her but giving her, belonged to him too, because he had to support the family. And we suggested that they should talk everything over as fully as possible, so that the whole family should be happy.
Yes.
No secrecy about it at all.
Yes, that answers my question very much. This business about not enjoying intercourse and so on, you've got a marvellous perspective on the situation because you've got two clinics, one in Weymouth Street and one in Kensington. Now, did you find the same situation in Weymouth Street in your clients there?
Very near. But as time went on, this is an interesting historical fact. Now, I never thought of that before, as to what was the motive that really did it. And I suppose it's this. The sex experience to all adults is universal. The wish to enjoy anything, from roast beef upwards or downwards, is also universal. Therefore, you've got a very sympathetic public. If you can do two things for them, if you can say, pregnancy, you needn't think about it. Enjoying relations with your partner or your husband is a natural thing in itself, but it is a thing to be educated. It isn't spontaneous in this country, as far as we know. It might be spontaneous in Samoa. Margaret Mead found it with those girls there. Yes. But it certainly is not spontaneous in an Anglo-Saxon country. And what we were trying here and there, we've now got it out in so many words, is to make them realize that education to be a good sex partner was as necessary as educated and to learn Latin.
So when you went from Kensington to Weymouth Street, you weren't moving from an area where the woman didn't enjoy sex to an area where women did enjoy sex. It was the same in both.
Well, it was... no, it wasn't the same. Because in Weymouth Street, with those thousands of people, they were far more conscious. And as time went by, very quickly, it would be they who would initiate the conversation. At the clinic, never. I was offering a bewildered wife something that she thought was, goodness me, what's the woman talking about? But with my other people, they would come to me, especially soon after marriage, and say, well, this is a bore. And nobody told me anything about me on her first visit. Of course, if she had the good luck to come to me before marriage, when they were engaged, I then had my golden opportunity of teaching her everything. Mm. So she would actually enjoy even her wedding night, which was very rare.
Yeah. Was it really?
Well, the other ones who came after they were married, and the thrillers, they realised that the atmosphere in that particular room, they could say anything they liked.
I mean, could I just ask you, is that the major difference between the two places, Weymouth Street and Kensington, that the Weymouth Street patients, and we're talking about before the Second World War, are much more articulate and much more able to talk?
Well, obviously, because they were educated people.
That's the major difference.
And I had lots of university people.
Yes.
But what was interesting was that there's no essential relationship between education and sex technique or sex instinct or gift or anything you like. It had to be learned.
Well, that's very interesting, because you really have got a marvellous perspective on that, Philly. Did you actually subsidise your poor patients by your rich patients? You see what I mean? I mean, did you use the money that you got in Weymouth Street to help finance the clinic in Kensington, or were they quite separate?
No, you couldn't do that. That would lead to muddles, because you've got to think of the clinic in Kensington was only one of a thousand. The finances of the whole movement had to be very carefully organised, and I had a lot to do with that too, but that was quite different. And the universal rule, each new clinic had to have the objective of being self-supporting. They could ask for charity from anyone they liked, but they were expected to be self-supporting. And I've told you, I think, my only good trade idea I ever had, which was so successful in Kensington that they made about £200 a month by the sensible selling of the things.
Yes. But, I mean, presumably, you know, you're working more cheaply, in a sense, by going to Kensington. You're giving them your time, aren't you? Or was it...
You have a small fee.
And presumably,
3 guineas a session or something.
I see. I mean, if you were really out just to make money and nothing else, you wouldn't have gone to Kensington at all, would you? I would put it crudely.
I couldn't imagine doing such a thing. I'm not interested in money at all.
No, but I mean, if that was the case, you would never have gone there, would you? I mean, there's nothing in it financially.
No, yes, think a bit more. Think a bit deeper. Let's see what sort of a person we're thinking about. We're thinking about a young graduate. A young girl, unmarried, who has decided she's going to do gynecology. She wishes to make money. How is she going to do it? She can't get any private patients unless she has skill. How can she get skill? She can't learn on private patients. Because she daren't, made a mistake. Then, even now, only the National Health Service taking on, the only places where skill could be learnt was the Family Planning Association. So we had hundreds of these young graduates who came to us, had to go through my invented training course. They had to acquire a certificate, which was given by the society, and could then apply to a clinic to come on the staff. It was enormously worth their while.
I understand, yeah.
And without them, they could do nothing.
Can you tell me what there was at the headquarters of the Family Planning Association in the 30s? I mean, what was there? Was it just one room?
In the 30s?
Yes.
Yes. As Margaret Pike said in her article, there was only one room and 6 chairs and a borrowed typewriter.
Just an office, nothing else.
A room. It's hardly even called an office. But that grew fairly quickly. Now here we come to the international influence backwards. That as soon as we got to 48, and I'm not quite sure of the dates, the other people were interested in each other, and they would say, well, what are you doing in your country? And the next thing that happened to us, through Pip Blacker, was this Eugenic Society, which had nothing to do with us at all, but where a rich set of people gave us free office space in their office in Eccleston Square. Now, the next amusing thing was the effect of that on the Americans. Now, the Americans are money conscious from their first breath. And in America, they were extremely extravagant. They had very elaborate clinics. They paid their doctors well. Their headquarters were a grand office. And they sent someone over and said, what are they doing in England? And they also came back. In London, they got two girls in an attic.
Can I give you some more tea? There is plenty more here.
Yes, and what can we do with this, sir?
Would you like me to throw this out and give you some more?
Yes.
Let's do that. In the kitchen?
Yes. No, not as far as the kitchen. Immediately opposite the door.
All right. Yeah. So it's a very small affair, really, the Family Planning Association, until the IPPF and the Eugenic Society get connected.
Very small affair for 10 years, 18 years. But the actual figures from that you can probably get
from the annual
from
report.
Margaret Park House.
Yes, yes. What about, so the war really has no effect on the domestic English movement at all, really?
It had one very comic effect. I don't know if you noticed that. But when the war started in 1939, we suddenly found there was no more rubber. Which, at that moment, was a perfect horror. What were we going to do? So we sent out scouts, and as usual, something unusual happened. Somebody, I've forgotten who, got in touch with a wholesale rubber firm who had a very large order for the floors and bathrooms of a hotel in Paris.
Which was
cut off. And this party-coloured, square yards of it, we could buy for nothing. And what is amusing is that those caps, no two the same, because the colours are very different, they have become historic.
But
many coloured caps.
What about the effect of military service on people's attitude to birth control? I mean, it did have an effect in the First World War, didn't it, rather? I wondered if it spread in the Second.
Well, it's very difficult to say. What happened?
And the English movement doesn't.
One thing to show you how very slow men are. By the Second World War, 1939, we had a certain amount of experience. And we knew that we could help. And I got into with a war office with someone who was in the RAMC, who had power. And I sat opposite and I said, now, you've got women in your machine. You've got four different kinds of women. Those are girls. Those girls need protection. It's absolutely certain they will become pregnant. Very stiff. But he said, what have ever got here? Sitting there. We, and only we, can save them. Now, I'm here to make you a definite practical offer. You will allow us. The recognized family planning movement, the properly trained doctors, to have a definite place in the medical part of the care of these thousands of young women you will have. And what do you suppose he said? He looked at me and he said, entirely impossible, Dr. Wright. Hmm. He was unmovable. He didn't care a scrap for those girls. Hmm. Had no sympathy whatever. Now, the consequence to us was that we knew this would happen, but we decided we would do what little we could. So we had pregnant girls from the various services in our house, and we had six of them.
So you mean in your own personal house?
Yes, but saw them through their pregnancies, helped them to the babies. Mm. Well, it was a tiny little thing, but it was a gesture.
Mm. But the English movement doesn't really grow fast till the 1950s, does it? It's curious, isn't it?
And it had no effect. It couldn't move the wall, the men in the military men.
So really, even for the English movement's history, you would say the war is not significant, particularly?
Not significant at all.
Mm. That's interesting. It's very interesting.
It's sad, it's tragic.
Yes. Yes.
There's hundreds of girls that had to go through unwanted pregnancies.
Yes. One last thing I...
And wait, I was put in the other side. The medical care of all those women was in the hands of men doctors.
Mm.
Well, they hadn't got enough human feeling to say, well, all right, this is part of our responsibility. We alone to teach them, not a bit of it.
Mm.
And that's where we find men very disappointing.
About sort of your opponents, really, it leads on to opponents. What about what are called rubber shops? That is, I mean, it seems to me one of the situation between the wars is not are you for birth control or against it? It's do you want birth control to take place through medical and proper channels? Or do you want it to take place through illegal or unsuitable channels, i.e. rubber shops, backstreet abortions and so on? So in other words, your enemies, in a sense, are presumably these amateurs in the field, aren't they?
Well...
Did you feel that at the time?
Can you see a handkerchief in
Yes.
Yes and no. In the broad sense, we had nothing to do with the rubber shops at all. They were entirely independent. And also, we were very undictatorial. If a man would go into a rubber shop and buy 20 sheets, we said, bless you. It's better than nothing.
Mm-hmm.
But girls would never go into a rubber shop to be taught a cap.
Why not? Just because they were like...
There was nothing, there was no one to teach them.
It's a
piece of medical skill. But now where you're coming on to with that question is quite a different affair. As soon as pills were invented, then there was a whole different field where theoretically the rubber shops, the chemists, could help. But that is still a very moot point.
Mm.
Is it on the whole good or not good that the pill should be freely
available
without prescription?
Mm.
As I've had so many years of experience with the dangers of pills, nothing to do with contraception.
Yeah. Yes.
I say not.
Yes. I mean, in Kensington, were there a number of rubber shops before the war? Where people could go?
That.
I mean, you weren't in any sense in rivalry with nearby.
I wouldn't know.
Yes, I see.
Because
you just
I was so busy, I drove to Kensington to that little street and drove back.
Yes, you had nothing to do with that world at all, really.
You never looked.
Yes. And in a sense, another group of people who you're doing out of business are backstreet abortionists, aren't you, in a way?
Not then. Not until 67.
How's that, then?
Because the law regulating abortions didn't come into existence until 67.
Yes, oh yes, I know that, but presumably if women don't have children...
Oh, taking them.
They're taking their custom
away. I hope
away,
so.
But still, I suppose it's so small.
Well, we hope so, but we had no means of knowing.
No, But again, you never come across these this world at all, do you? I mean, it's quite separate.
The only way that I would personally, in my own practice, come across them would be an occasional victim who had not had the factory abortion, who had gone to somebody in Harlesford and paid £100 or something like that for an abortion, and then came to me afterwards. Mm. At a time when I couldn't help up because it was done. And it was never, we haven't touched on that at all, because it isn't strictly the same theory. After a pregnancy has occurred, that's not our field, but we made it our field because of the misery of the women.
Mm. Mm. Yes, yes, of course.
And succeeded.
Were you the only person in the Harley Street area giving advice to private clients?
I don't like Harley Street area. I don't like Harley Street. You were Weymouth Street.
Yes.
I can't tell you.
I mean, you weren't the only one.
Sure not. Mm. But that's me again. I work by myself. I don't know what the others are doing. Mm. And I was far too busy to find out. Mm. Mm. And the colleagues who were in the movement, of course, we knew all about and helped them as much as we could. Mm. And as far as I was concerned, I was engaged on another thing, which in the end was successful, to find a successor for my own enormous private practice. And I found only three. First one, Greta Graf, who was so good, she took her own consulting room in the same building.
G-R-A-A-F, is that?
G-R-A-S. No, G-R-A-F-F.
I see, yes.
From South Africa. Mm. Geraldine Howard, who also was the successful, got her own jobs. And last, I found Jean Infield.
And you distributed your patients among their...
No, not like that. This was 15, 20 years ago. As I was teaching all the time various people, I was all the time looking after an exceptional person. And I found these three. The third was Jean Infield, who was very young. She was about 26, 27. And she had no idea of doing gynecology.
Is that Infield or E-N?
I-N-F-I-E-L-D. Yes. Mm. And at the end of her third lesson, I said to her, now wait till the clinic is finished and come and talk to me. She didn't know what was going to happen. So I sat her down, same chair. I said, now then, Dr. Infield, I taught you, you're very good. In the future, you're going to be me. She was horrified. She said, that's absolutely bull. I said, don't talk nonsense. I'm talking, not you. And I'm going to tell you how it's going to work out. I'm going to send you, you're thoroughly trained, you've taken the money, you're a responsible person, and you do it well. I'm going to send you your first 20 patients free. She hadn't even thought of doing gynecology. And you will use them to learn on. And you'll see how you get on. I left her alone. 15 years later, when my practice was 50,579 individuals, I said, now then, Jean, the time has come. And for the first time in history, I passed over, of course, money wasn't concerned at all, an enormous consulting private practice, with all their records, all their name cards, to another person. It's never been done before, but she's now had just over a year, and she's doing very well. Mm. Because this was the kind of practice I felt it simply couldn't be stopped like that.
Mm. It's very interesting. Did you ever come across Edith Howe Martin?
Oh yes, I quite forgot her. Of course we did. Now then, Edith Howe Martin. Oh, this goes a long way back. Now, she, on her own, now who did she work with? She worked with...
She wrote a history of the birth control movement, among other things, somebody called Beale.
Well, she had, I think, and it was called the National Committee...
Yes.
Something like that, for birth control...
Yes, I can find that out. She certainly was active on her own at one point.
But she was very independent. She went to India.
That's right.
And she worked with the Americans.
Can you tell me what sort of person she was? Do you remember anything
yes,
about
her? Yes, I can remember. She was a very forthcoming, active, executive person.
Efficient, practical.
Was very efficient. Mm. We were never against each other.
Because she's
because
a very interesting
woman. Because we absorbed the committee.
Yes, that's right. Yes, I just wondered if you remembered her at all.
No, I do remember her. And she had lots to do with India.
Yes. Two other very remarkable women, according to your articles anyway, are Lady Denman and Margaret Pike, aren't they?
Yes.
I mean, they're
yes.
key
yeah,
figures.
We couldn't have got on without them.
Yes.
They were sent us by fate.
Yes. Yes, that's really leads me up to, in a sense, the denouement of the whole thing. Mm. You see yourself as not having much initiative at all, don't you, really? You are on a wave, so to speak, or on the crest of a wave that's moving you on, almost within
now, wait, you can't put it like that, because the wave... No, that's a very good question. It shows you haven't thought deeply enough. but I can make it quite clear. The wave of public spirit, of sympathy, the importance of the subject itself does nothing to teach. We had to have the whole initiative to utilize the wave.
Yes. And I think you used the phrase, I can't remember the exact phrase you used last time, but you said something like we were in touch with the spirit of the time.
Yes,
something like
yes.
that.
Yes, we were in touch with the spirit of the time, but the spirit of the time isn't executive.
No. I mean the initiative comes in seeing what the spirit of the time is, which you did, of
in
course.
In implementing it.
Yes, yes. But... In a sense, you were active at the right moment, and
we
everything helped.
We were active at the right
you.
Moment. We were flowing with it.
Mm. Mm.
But we were essential as individuals to find out what to do.
Yes, yes, yes. But you could have done the same things 50 years earlier, and you wouldn't have had any effect.
Well, all sorts of people tried.
Yes.
Mm. And that's a very interesting history. You'll find that plenty of people who have written the pre-us.
Mm.
They now have succeeded.
Mm. Mm.
They weren't at the right time.
Yes, yes. I don't know whether you would want to answer a question like this. You might not, so stop me if you wouldn't. You started off as a missionary in a way, mm-hmm. didn't you? Well, you were a missionary.
I am a missionary.
Yes. I mean, is that a thread of continuity in your life, really? I'm just a missionary for a different cause.
Well, I thought it must be. But I would say propagandist.
Yes.
You see, the word missionary in itself is somebody sent. A propagandist is inside.
Yes. Yes.
We were definitely missionaries in China because we were sent from England to China. It's entirely right, the word was right. But when we came back, you can't be a missionary in your own country. It's not the right word. Your Latin
no.
is wrong.
Mm. Well, you're sent...
You're a propagandist.
You're sent by the Family Planning Association in a way.
Well,
not sure,
I was
suppose,
the family
but you on the yes,
I sent myself.
yes, yes, yes. but, you see, I was really wondering about your... and. You may think this is an impertinent question.
No,
I mean, your motive, you see. I mean, is it a religious... Do you have a religious
no,
feeling
no,
behind it?
No, it had no
it,
religious feeling at all.
Mm.
It was humanitarian.
Yes, I see.
It was humanitarian, and from my point of view, it stemmed from my sympathy for women. You can say, from my point of view, like that kind of a feminist. I have the greatest respect, admiration for women. And I think they're far more admirable than men. I wouldn't work with men. I think they're higher up the spiritual scale. They're far more unselfish. Intelligence has got nothing to do with it. And those are the people I wanted to work with.
Mm. So
and those are the people I wanted to help.
Your feminism.
Being a woman myself.
Mm. Your feminism doesn't spring from any sort of principles exactly.
No,
it springs
no,
from
no. It
observation
just,
of women's situations.
Spontaneous.
Yes.
And self-feeding.
Yes.
Because as these patients grew in their thousands, I felt more and more self-justification. these are the people I want to work with. These are the people I want to help.
One of the most interesting things you said last time was how you learned from your patients.
Yes.
I mean, in a sense, it's a sort of self-generating
movement. All the time. Because in that room at 9 Wayman Street, there were no restrictions of any kind. And everybody felt they could say just what they liked.
So that in a way you were a pupil of your patients. I mean, you were learning from them all the time.
It was mutual. Of course, depended on the patients.
Yes, that's very, very
interesting. And luckily I had every possible kind, from the top to the bottom.
Yeah, that's most interesting. So that in a sense it's a genuinely democratic movement in a way.
Yes,
I mean, it's
absolutely.
That's really marvellous. Yes, we must. That's very, very interesting indeed. Very, very interesting. Let me switch off. Oh, okay.